Okay. Let's start again. what's today's date? 23rd of August. We're in Ljubljana in Slovenia, right? Yes, okay, good. So this is a seminar called Srila Prabhupada, the Living Bhagavatam. I traveled with Srila Prabhupada from November 1975 up until the end of March 77. So it's about 16 months. And during that period, I was keeping a daily diary of just a record of what Prabhupada was doing, where he was traveling to, who he was meeting with, and sometimes, you know, whatever the significant events of the day were. And at the same time, I was also recording as much of Prabhupada's conversations and lectures that it was possible. So that was a kind of an electronic diary as well as the written diary. And then later on what I did was I gathered from the Bhaktivedanta archives all the correspondence that Prabhupada shared with the devotees during that period. So I got all the letters that were written to Srila Prabhupada, as well as Prabhupada's replies. And then later on, beginning about 1986, I started up a project of combining all those materials into what later became called a Transcendental Diary, so that I brought things out in a book form. And so far there are 5 volumes of that book, Transcendental Diary. The last volume just came out this year, in about March. And each volume covers about a 2-month period. The first volume 4 months, and then after that the other 4 volumes cover a 2-month period. And it gives a very detailed look at Srila Prabhupada's activities on a daily basis. So what I've done with this particular seminar is I took different topics of devotional service, different activities, like prasadam, chanting, cleanliness, health, book writing, book distribution, etc. And whatever Prabhupada said or did in relation to those particular topics, then I put them all, compiled them all together into these segments for this seminar. So since last year I've been kind of touring around and telling the devotees about these different leelas of Srila Prabhupada. And the reason why I called it the Living Bhagavatam is because when I first joined Srila Prabhupada, we had been in New Delhi for about 3 or 4 days, and then Prabhupada went to Vrindavan and on December the 2nd, 75. And when we went to Vrindavan, it was only at that point that I was actually added to Srila Prabhupada's party as his full-time servant. For the few days before that, I was just kind of giving him his massages. So I moved into Prabhupada's quarters, and I remember very clearly and distinctly sitting in the afternoon in Prabhupada's darshan room. Prabhupada was sitting at his desk. There was probably about 50 or 60 visitors there, you know, just came. In India, of course, many people come when they hear that there's a sadhu in town. They like to go there and have a darshan, and generally they just sit there and look at you. Sometimes one or two of them ask questions. And so Prabhupada would, every afternoon, especially in Vrindavan, he would have this open darshan from about 4:30 until about 6:30. Then when the arati began, then he would send everybody off to see the deities and participate in the kirtan. So that first afternoon that I was with Prabhupada as his full-time servant, I was watching him, you know, giving this darshan and just observing him. And it struck me very, very strongly that everything that I'd ever read about Krishna consciousness, you know, from all the books, Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Nectar of Devotion, etc., all the characteristics of a devotee that are described there, then I saw them, you know, in a moment in the character of Srila Prabhupada. And it just hit me very strongly that Srila Prabhupada was like a living, breathing Bhagavatam. And I realized that, you know, because you can read the Bhagavatam, and there's so much in there, and most of what we read is kind of intellectually perceived, at least it was for me at that time. You know, I had caught the idea, but, you know, the realization of the descriptions there, because that would take a long time in coming. And maybe lifetimes you have to read, you know, the Shastra before you really realize what it's talking about. But I saw that in an instant, everything was there in Prabhupada's character, in the way that he moved, in the way that he dealt with people, in the way that he spoke, in the way that he dealt with, you know, different problems that may have arisen, in his philosophical presentations. Everything about him was just, you know, the epitome of pure devotional service. So I just made up my mind that I would spend every available moment that I had whilst I was traveling with Prabhupada just observing him and listening to him, so that I could understand very quickly what Krishna consciousness actually was. It was, you know, manifest there right before my very eyes in the form of Srila Prabhupada. So, you know, I saw Prabhupada there as a living, breathing Bhagavatam. And I thought that that would be a nice title for this kind of seminar, Srila Prabhupada, the Living Bhagavatam. Because it's only actually from the practical examples of the lives of the devotees that we really understand what it means to practice and live as devotees ourselves. You know, we can read things and get some intellectual idea, but to actually live the life, that requires a practical example for us. So I understood, is Srila Prabhupada, all I have to do is just watch him, and I'll learn, you know, everything about devotional service, or practically everything about devotional service, at least up to my own capacity. So this seminar then is called Srila Prabhupada, the Living Bhagavatam, and due to some technical limitations tonight, we only have two topics that we can choose from, because the other topics, I can't get them up on the screen, unfortunately. But I've got here chanting or prasadam pastimes. So you can decide what you would like to hear about. You want to hear about chanting or prasadam?
Chanting.
Chanting. Everybody in favor of chanting? Put your hands up. Let's see. Everybody in favor of prasadam? Yeah, only one. Okay. Chanting it is. The chanters have it. Okay, good. It worked. Great. So, chanting, of course, that was the essence of Srila Prabhupada's mission. There's no question of that. And there's one story that I heard after Prabhupada's disappearance. I'll relate it now. It's a hearsay. I wasn't personally present when this conversation went on, but it very succinctly summarizes why Prabhupada was successful in spreading Krishna consciousness. So this was a conversation that I heard about between two of Prabhupada's godbrothers. One of them was Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji, who was well known in the Gaudiya Math. He was I think practically the only disciple of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, who Srila Bhaktisiddhanta gave approval that all he had to do was chant and nothing else. He was you know, one of those rare souls that could actually chant 64 rounds or 100 rounds a day and be happy doing that. So, you know, he was an expert in chanting. And then the man that he was talking to was Bon Maharaj, who was the disciple, along with a couple of others, that had been sent to England in the 1930s by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta to hopefully spread the Krishna consciousness movement. After several years, he came back with not much result. So anyway, Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji was speaking with Bon Maharaj, apparently. And so he was comparing the Bon Maharaj with Srila Prabhupada. and he was telling Von Maharaj, he said, what is the difference between you and Swami Maharaj? He said, you're a scholar. He was also a scholar. You're expert in English. He also expert in English. You went to the West, and he went to the West. He was successful, and you were not. Why? So he asked the question, and then he answered the question himself. He said, because he had great faith in the holy names. So that was Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji's summary of why Prabhupada was successful and Bon Maharaj was not. Because Prabhupada had this tremendous faith in the power of the holy names. And actually, that was recognized by at least some of Prabhupada's godbrothers, not all of them. A lot of them were not very appreciative, at least during Prabhupada's lifetime, of what he had done. But another godbrother that was appreciating was a very dear friend of his, that was B.R. Sridhar Swami. And of course they'd been close friends for many, many years. They'd preached together in Calcutta when Prabhupada was a householder and he was living at Sitakanta Banerjee Lane. Then he had persuaded Sridhar Maharaj to rent the rooms next door and make that into a small preaching center. And Prabhupada was involved with their efforts to spread Krishna consciousness. So on March the 15th, 1976, Prabhupada was resident in Mayapur, and he had invited this godbrother, Sridhar Swami, to come over and visit with him. So Sridhar Swami came over, and Prabhupada sent his car over to bring him from Navadvip, where he had his mutt. So he stayed for most of the afternoon. He and Prabhupada took prasadam together on the veranda. Srila Prabhupada had him stay in the room right next to his own, and then after a light rest, they talked for the rest of the afternoon. During their conversations, they exchanged reports on each other's preaching activities. Srila Prabhupada told me afterwards that Sridhar Maharaj had said that he regarded him as the real Acharya. Sridhar Maharaj told him that Lord Chaitanya had given his prediction that the chanting of the holy name would go to every town and village, Prativitaya, Chajato, and Agarati Gram, but that he and his godbrothers had not taken this statement literally. Now, by Srila Prabhupada's efforts, he said that he could understand its real meaning. So that was the prediction of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that his holy names would be chanted in every town and village of the world. But actually, most of the godbrothers thought it was just some nice poetic, you know, description to invoke some good sentiments, but they never actually thought of it in a literal sense until Prabhupada went to the West and actually did it and spread Krishna consciousness to all the five continents of the world. So he was appreciating that then Prabhupada actually had this power to spread the holy names all over the world. And of course, previously there had been this fight for succession. Immediately after Srila Bhaktisiddhanta had left the planet, then within 2 years, the whole Gaudiya mission had broken up into factions. And there was fighting going on from three directions as to who would be the next Acharya. And one godbrother succeeded in the court after many years in getting the court to declare that he was the next Acharya. So he was a court-approved Acharya. But now Sridhar Maharaj was saying, now we can understand who the real Acharya is, because you've actually spread the holy name all over the world and fulfilled this prediction. So that was Prabhupada's potency. And actually when Prabhupada first went to the West, he had written a small pamphlet, which he took with him on the Jaladuta, for distribution when he arrived in America. And when we were with Prabhupada in New Mayapur in France, in August of 1976, someone had produced a copy of this leaflet that Prabhupada had taken with him 10 years before to begin his preaching work. And so on August the 4th, I was sitting in Prabhupada's room. This original leaflet that he had printed was given to us, and I showed it to Srila Prabhupada. So Prabhupada was curious to see it, asking me to read it out to him. His picture was on the front, with the title reading, Srimad Bhagavatam, India's Message of Peace and Goodwill. 60 volumes of elaborate English English version by Trudandi Goswami, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, carried by the Sindhya Steam Navigation Company Limited, Bombay, all over the world for scientific knowledge of God. So that was the heading. While Prabhupada relaxed behind his desk, I read out to him the body of the text. It says, "The sufferings of the entire human society can at once be brought under control simply by individual practice of Bhakti Yoga, a simple and easy process of chanting the holy name of God. Every country, every nation, and every community throughout the world has some conception of the holy name of God. And as such, either the Hindus or the Mohammedans or the Christians, everyone can easily chant the holy name of God in a meditative mood, and that will bring about the required peace and goodwill in the present problematic human society. Any inquiry in this connection will be gladly answered by Sri Swamiji. The Hindus generally chant the holy name of God in 16 chain of transcendental sound, composed of 32 alphabets as Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. The Vedic literatures like the Upanishads and Puranas recommend the chanting of the above-mentioned 16 holy names at a stretch. And Lord Sri Chaitanya, whose cult of chanting the holy name of God, gave special importance on these transcendental sounds. In this age of Kali, or in the age of hate, hypocrisy, corruption, and quarrel, the only remedial measure is that every man should chant the holy name of the Lord, both individually and collectively." Then it went on to give the English translations of the 8 prayers written by Lord Chaitanya in glorification of the holy name. It ended with some highly complimentary reviews of Prabhupada's translation of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So that was Prabhupada's opening propaganda sheet, that he was going there and this was his intention. He was going to get everybody to chant the holy names of the Lord, and that will solve all the problems in the world. That was Prabhupada's conviction. And because he had that conviction, therefore immediately when he began chanting, it had immediate effect, because Prabhupada had realized that Krishna and his name were the same, and therefore he was relying on Krishna to do everything, and he was just going as Krishna's messenger. So you see that, you know, in the early days, there's that nice film of Srila Prabhupada on the hippie hill, as they used to call it, in San Francisco. And Prabhupada's just standing there and he's chanting and he's clapping like this, and all the hippies are all dancing in circles around him. When I first saw that film, I thought that, you know, it just reminded me, or it made me think of, you know, the incident when Lord Chaitanya was going through the Jarakanda forest and he was chanting and all the animals came, and the tigers and the antelopes and the elephants and everything were all embracing each other and chanting Hare Krishna. So all their natural animosity was forgotten and they were all united in the chanting of the holy names. And that's actually what it was like for Srila Prabhupada coming into the West. You know, he was coming into a place where there was no culture. At least from his standards, he was a sadhu who had been living, he was a pure devotee, living in Vrindavan, never been out of the country, and then he arrives in America, you know, one of the grossest places on the planet, you know, where people were indulging in all kinds of unrestricted, you know, sense gratification, especially the hippies. I mean, that place in San Francisco in 67, that was really the end of all morality, you know, and moral standards in America at that time, and that spread all over the world. And people were, you know, high as kites on LSD and various kinds of drugs. They were having sex right there in public on the lawn, right in front of them. But Prabhupada walked right in the middle of the whole thing and just started chanting. And he got all these animalistic people up and dancing, going around in circles and chanting and like that. That was Prabhupada's power. Remarkable achievement. So, an indication of Prabhupada's mentality, actually, was revealed in a little exchange that we had with Prabhupada again in New Mayapur. This was on August the 2nd, 1976. And Harikesh and myself were in Prabhupada's room just talking with him. And Prabhupada was laughing. And he told us that our Bon Maharaj, same god brother that had gone to the West, once I was eating in his festival. So Bon Maharaj had had a festival in Vrindavan before Prabhupada left for the West. So he's a Bodhisaib. A sahib means a Westerner, and Bodhisaib means a big Westerner. It's a kind of a, like a derogatory reference that sometimes Indians make, you know, the Pukka Indians make against the Westernized Indians, that how he's become a Bodhisaib. Means he's given up his culture and he's become like a Westerner. So Prabhupada was saying about Bon Maharaj, he's a Bodhisaib. So he is given knife and fork. So I did not know. I do not remember even which way I took the fork. So Bon Maharaj began to criticize. Oh, you were going to the foreign country and you do not know which way to take this knife and fork? So I told him, I'm not going to learn all these things. I am going to teach them something else to forget it. You went there to learn these things, but I'm not going there to learn anything. So that was before Prabhupada came to the West. He was very fixed on what he was going to do. He was going to go and teach people to chant the holy name. He wasn't going to go and learn anything from the Westerners. So that was how Prabhupada started. And June 21st, 1976, we were in a car going to New Vrindavan. Kintananda Maharaj was there. Of course, he had joined the Krishna consciousness movement 10 years before, in 1966, when Prabhupada had just got set up there in 26 Second Avenue in New York. So we were visiting New Vrindavan for a few days. Although it was a 90-minute drive to New Vrindavan, the ride was comfortable. And as we progressed smoothly down the highway, Prabhupada kept up a running conversation. He reflected on the fallen condition of modern man, telling Kirtananda Maharaj his comparison of the dogs running on four legs and man's running on four wheels. It was a nice comparison that he made sometimes. He said that the only way to save them was to start with the basics, and then after some time, when they become a little purified, then give them some philosophy. He reminded Kintananda that this had been his program right from the very beginning. You all have got this experience, he said. This is the only way. I started this movement on this determination, that I'll give them prasadam, nice chanting, and they will not come. They must come. This was my determination. And I began with this. So this is the only way. Give them the chance. No talk, please come. Chant and dance with us and take Krishna prasadam and go home. Kintananda reflected that it was just 10 years ago that he had first met Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada gave one of his endearing little sideways nods of assent. Yes, I never said that you have to give up this, you have to do that. Never said. Then gradually, chaito darpana marjanam. When the heart becomes cleansed, then a little. There is no hopelessness. So that was his idea, that he would immediately just chant and everything would happen as a result of the chanting. So on December the 8th, 1975, we were in Vrindavan and Prabhupada made a reference to those early days in New York. He was giving his Bhagavatam class and he recalled how in the early days of ISKCON in New York, his neighbors would protest at the morning chanting. In the beginning, in that Second Avenue, 26, when our morning prayer was going on at 7, not early, and so many other tenants, half naked, they would complain to the landlord, "Oh, Mr. Judah, what is this going on? What is going on? Stop it, stop it, stop!" So Mr. Judah used to say, "No, no, they'll not stop. I cannot say. You go to the police." So sometimes the police were coming to stop us, but we did not stop. This brought a laugh to the assembled devotees. So that was Prabhupada. He was a revolutionary. Even the police came to stop him from chanting, but he wouldn't stop. So that's a little introduction, you know, the motivation that Prabhupada had, the methodology that he had for setting up ISKCON. It was all based on chanting and nothing else. And of course, you can only do that if you're an expert chanter yourself. So now we'll talk a little bit about japa. Because there's two forms of chanting, japa, which is individual, and then, of course, sankirtan or kirtan, when you do that with others. So we'll talk a little bit about japa first. Now, sometimes it comes up, people ask, how many rounds did Prabhupada chant? Because we chant 16 rounds, and sometimes, you know, there's a question like that. It's one of those questions that I regret never having asked Srila Prabhupada personally. So I can't say, you know, for sure from my own experience how many rounds Prabhupada chanted. But I can say that Prabhupada was always chanting whenever he had any spare time, and that he did definitely chant a fixed number of rounds every single day. There's no question of that. Now we'll get into how many of that in a minute. But Shruta Kirti Prabhu, who was Prabhupada's servant for about 2 years, he has written a book. It's right now it's only electronic form. It's not printed. Jai Shushi Panchatattva Ki Jai. He's written a book called Srila Prabhupada Uvacha. And what he's done is he's put together about 130-something little vignettes or recollections of incidents with Prabhupada. So he recalls that it was easy to understand that Srila Prabhupada enjoyed chanting japa. He always stressed the importance of chanting our 16 rounds. He once told me that as a householder, he used a simple process for completing 16 rounds that we could also apply. When I was a householder, he said, I would chant 4 rounds before each meal, and then 4 rounds before retiring in the evening. So you eat 3 times a day, and then 4 rounds before you go to bed. That's 16 rounds. So in this way, 16 rounds could be chanted without difficulty. Then he laughed and he said, if you don't take prasadam before you chant your 4 rounds, then you will be sure to get them chanted. In other words, nobody misses taking prasadam. So if you make a determination, I'll chant 4 rounds before each meal, and I won't eat until I chant them, then you're sure to chant your rounds. So that was Prabhupada's saying to Shruta Kirti. So he definitely was chanting 16 rounds when he was a householder. Now, there is a recollection from one of Prabhupada's godbrothers, a devotee called Nayananda Das Babaji, who I think just left his body a couple of years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, in Mayapur. He was at Champahati. There's a temple there, and he'd been there for, I don't know, 60 years or something, as the pujari. Long, long time, since he was a small boy. So he recalls, there's a book that's been produced called Our Srila Prabhupada, A Friend to All, I think, which has been put out by Mula Prakriti Dasi. She just left her body last year. Which is a series of interviews from people that knew Srila Prabhupada before, you know, he came to the West. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that everything in that book is 100%. You know, I'm quite sure that many of the things in that book are not. Because when you ask people to recall things from 50 years ago or 60 years ago, you know, they're sure to have, you know, forgotten some things, or, you know, things get a little fuzzy after some time with the memory. But at the same time, I've included this because it is, you know, a confirmation of at least his impression of Prabhupada chanting. So according to him, he says, as far as I understood, Sri Abhay Charanaravinda Prabhu, from when he first met Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and especially later, he kept the highest standards. Even though he hadn't requested formal initiation, we saw that he was chanting 64 rounds a day. This was during all the time that he was working full-time in his business. Whenever we met him, he was daily chanting and counting 1 lakh of names. When he got time off from work, he would immediately go to associate with the different devotees in the Gaudiya Mat. He would go to Bagh Bazar, which is Calcutta, or he would also go by train to Navadweep and Mayapur. So, Prabhupada told Shrutakirti he was doing 16 rounds as a householder. This man says he was under the impression Prabhupada was always chanting and was doing 64 rounds a day. So whether he's got that right or not, I'm not, you know, we can't say. Shushi Panchatatwa Ki Jai. But what I can say is that, of course, Prabhupada lived in Allahabad throughout the 1940s, 30s and 40s. He's made a reference that Prabhupada, when he had time off, would go by train to Navadweep, or he would go to the Bagh Bazar temple. Now, Prabhupada retired from family life in 1954. He moved back to Calcutta in sometime in the late 1940s. So, possibly this man is remembering Prabhupada from when he was back in Calcutta. And Prabhupada was very seriously involved at that point in the, you know, Gaudiya Mat activities. So at least he's under the impression he was chanting 64 rounds. But it's a confirmation of Prabhupada's eagerness to chant. So as I mentioned, I know that Prabhupada was chanting a fixed number, although I never asked him how many. And this was confirmed when Prabhupada was in Toronto in June of 1976. On the 18th, there were some professors that had come from Toronto University, Tom McConnell, and I think somebody called Shiva Raman, and a couple of others. So they were asking him, they were discussing with him about his books, and one of the professors asked him how long it had taken him to complete the Chaitanya Charitamrita, especially wondering when Prabhupada found the time to write. Prabhupada told him that it took a year and a half to complete the 17 volumes of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and he explained his schedule. I write in the night. I go to bed at 10:30. I get up at 12:30. Then I finish my chanting, if there is any balance, and then I begin dictating. So that's a confirmation from Srila Prabhupada in the middle of 1976 that he was chanting a fixed number, because at night time, if he had any balance of his rounds left, he would finish his chanting before he did his nightly dictation work. So my observation was that Prabhupada was chanting at least 16 rounds, and very often more than that. Especially when we spent 3 months in Vrindavan, Prabhupada practically every single night would, after the darshan, and he'd sent everybody off to the arati in the evening, he would go into the back garden, or he would sit in his darshan room, and he would, you know, just sit very quietly chanting his japa. And he would do that for a couple of hours. And when we were on tour, especially on the aeroplanes, then Prabhupada would spend his time on the planes always chanting. So he liked to do that. And Prabhupada's method of chanting was he used to chant almost silently. When he was chanting, you couldn't really hear. He could hear, but for another person, it was difficult to hear. But you could hear his beads clicking. He used to click his beads very loudly while he was chanting, very vigorous. And sometimes when there's, if you listen carefully to some of the conversation recordings, when Prabhupada's talking, you can hear this clicking going on in the background. That's his beads going as he's talking. So Prabhupada sometimes, he used to, you know, he would talk with people and he would chant at the same time. Not recommended for us. But Prabhupada was expert at chanting. And he explained one time that it's like sometimes when you see the Indian village ladies, so they go to the well and they have 3 or 4 big pots on their heads. So they fill up the pots and then they balance the pots on their heads, one above another. Sometimes you've seen at least 4 pots. And then they walk back, and as they're walking, they're talking to each other. So they're walking along, they've got these pots. And as they're talking about so many village katas, but the pot remains, and they don't spill anything, because they're expert. It's become second nature that they can carry these pots, they keep their necks stiff and the back straight, and they don't move their heads at all. But they're looking at each other and talking like this. And the pots are there, and they don't even have to hold onto the pots anymore. They never fall off. So Prabhupada gave that example that when you're expert in chanting, you're always chanting. The holy name is always on your lips. Sometimes silently or maybe out loud. And you can do other things. You can talk. But your mind is always on the holy name. So I saw that Prabhupada was, like that very often. So, now, why 16 rounds? Because we've heard the talk about, 64. That is said to be one standard. And, because in ISKCON we chant 16 rounds. So, this question was raised with Srila Prabhupada when we were in Vrindavan on December the 11th, 1975. We were out in a morning walk, and the temple president at that time was Akshayananda Swami. So he sought some Shastric verification for our standards of chanting japa, which some people have faulted. We were being criticized, oh, you're only chanting 16 rounds. That's not enough. So, of course, he said, we accept that when you tell us to chant 16 rounds, we accept that figure in full faith. You are the acharya. But what if we want to convince others, he said? Is there any Shastric or Vedic verse that we can refer to corroborate that at least we must chant 16 rounds or that many number of names? No, Prabhupada answered. In the Shastra it is not said like that. It is said Sankhya-purvaka, that you must fix up in numerical strength, whatever you can. But I have fixed up 16 rounds because you cannot do. It means you can't do 64. Akshayananda Swami confirmed, that's all we can do. And Prabhupada smiled and added with a touch of irony, yes, and that also difficult. Akshayananda Swami laughed, yes. Prabhupada continued, otherwise, Haridas Thakur, he was chanting 3 lakhs. So that is not possible. You should not try to imitate, but whatever you fix up, then you must do. That is wanted. Yes, Akshayananda Swami said, I was told that in the beginning you asked the first disciples to chant 64 rounds. Prabhupada said, yes. And they were unable, Akshayananda said. And to our laughter, he added, and then you asked them to chant 32? Prabhupada grinned. Sankhya purva ka nama gani nati bi. Sankhya purva, or numerical strength, must be there. So, you should follow rigidly. So if we are serious and sincere, then that means that 16 will increase to continuously chanting, Akshayananda said. You can do also now, Prabhupada said. It is not that because I've finished my 16 rounds, oh, that's it. You can increase, but that 16, that must be finished. Yes, Akshayananda Maharaj agreed. What I mean to say is that that is to bring us to the platform of chanting constantly. At least we must do that numerical number. And then if we're fortunate, we may finally be able to chant constantly, day and night. Yes, Prabhupada confirmed. So, one time I was with Brahmananda Prabhu, because he was one of the very first ones there at 26 Second Avenue. And we were talking about this, early days, and how Prabhupada had started off asking them to chant 64. And then after 1 or 2 days, they came back and they said, Swamiji, this is just too much. We just can't do so much chanting. So then he had said, all right, 32. And then after another day or two, they came back and they said, Swamiji, we just can't do this. This is too much. We just can't sit down for so long. So then Prabhupada had told them, all right, 16, but no less. And he stuck with that 16 from that time on. So Brahmananda once asked Srila Prabhupada, why did you do that? Why did you change 64, then 32, then 16? And Prabhupada told him, I was experimenting. So he was seeing what his Western disciples were capable of doing, and then he made, a standard that he felt that they could follow. It would demand a certain amount of, surrender and application from them. But at the same time, it wasn't necessarily the highest standard, but it was, a basic minimum. So he was experimenting. And that was, again, Prabhupada made a mention about why he did this. When we were in Vrindavan in 76 on September 17th, he was giving his class, and he explained that chanting a certain fixed number of rounds every day is one of the rules governing success. He said that Haridas Thakur chanted 3 lakhs of names per day, but Rupa Goswami was chanting less because he was writing books, although he still did a fixed number of rounds. So similarly, Prabhupada told us, we must have some numerical strength, and we have minimized. I know that you were coming from a different source. So, according to time, according to circumstance, and even then, there is no limit, you can chant more than 1600 names. But practically, we see that even chanting 16 rounds becomes difficult. So, don't try to imitate, but do it properly. What is advised by your spiritual master, without offense. That mantra will save you from the dangers of Maya. That is a fact. So that was a confirmation. Prabhupada made an adjustment because he knew, as he said, we were coming from a different source. So that 16 rounds was Prabhupada's standard. And even with people that weren't his initiated disciples, but who were, you know, following Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada stuck to that standard. And there's one good example. There was a professional tennis player. His name's Peter Burwatch. Some of you may know him. He was not famous, but he was well known. And when he gave up playing tennis himself, he set up a coaching organization. And he had, in this organization, he had men situated in various places all around the world in big, big hotels. So like, I met one of his men one time when I was in Indonesia. There's a big hotel there, the Borobudur. Very big hotel. And they had a resident professional tennis coach. And anybody that was staying at the hotel, they could, you know, get tennis lessons from the coach. So he was one of Peter Burwash's men. So Peter came to see Srila Prabhupada in Los Angeles on June the 6th in 1976, along with some of the members of his coaching organization. So he told Srila Prabhupada that the men that he signs up as staff coaches must follow the 4 regulative principles. And if they break them, they are released and they cannot rejoin. And this is actually written into their contracts. And these are not devotees, these are just people that joined his organization. They try to preach, although not too directly. And if someone shows a favorable attitude, then they try to nurture it. A few of them are tuned in to the more spiritual side of things and gradually introduced to the philosophy if they show some inclination. He said the biggest difficulty is the long hours that they work. A regimen of 16 or 18 hour work days makes it difficult for them to chant 16 rounds. So he asked Prabhupada if it was all right to chant only 8 or 10 rounds. Prabhupada appreciated their sincerity and was very friendly to them, but he held firm to the standard of 16. So the meeting was very congenial, and Prabhupada thanked them for their efforts and encouraged them to continue. So Peter was chanting 8 rounds a day himself, and as far as I know, he always stuck to that standard despite what Prabhupada said there at that meeting. But Prabhupada wouldn't budge, even though he was not an initiated disciple. He said, no, you have to chant 16, that's our standard. So that 16 rounds, then that was a requirement. And especially Prabhupada always insisted that if anybody wanted to take up any, you know, position of authority in the Krishna consciousness movement, then, you know, following the 4 regulative principles and chanting 16 rounds a day was an absolute must if you wanted to be, you know, like any kind of a leader in the movement. So on January the 7th, 1976, Prabhupada was in South India in a place called Nellore, and he got a letter from the GBC of the South Seas, means Australia, Fiji, New Zealand, that was Madhavisa Swami. So he wrote from Fiji explaining some managerial problems that were confronting him. The society in Fiji is being organized mainly by an Indian man, Mr. Deoji Punja, and his family. and gradually others are becoming involved. In legally registering ISKCON, Madhavisa wants to make sure that all the trustees are conforming to Srila Prabhupada's standards, following the regulative principles and chanting 16 rounds a day. Mr. Punja is adhering to these principles, but one or two of the other present trustees are not, although they are very favorable and are given large donations. So he requested Prabhupada to ask them personally to stand down as trustees in favor of Dayalji's brother, Karshanji. So Prabhupada knows that it's a sensitive issue. The impetus for the establishment of ISKCON Fiji arose originally from Dayalji and his brother's enthusiasm to invite Srila Prabhupada to come there. Well, just lost my place here. Prabhupada does not want to act in a way that might strike people as being arbitrary. Thus he advised Madhavisa to arrange everything locally with a consensus of agreement. In other words, he didn't want to have to say, all right, these two men are not following, they have to resign. Because then they might take it badly and then they would lose faith in him. So he said, but if you can get a local consensus agreement that, you know, this is not good, you actually have to be up to this standard, and then they voluntarily step down, then that would be the best thing. So that's what he advised. If any of the trustees are to be dropped, he said, this has to be discussed between the trustees themselves. These are all important men, and we should be careful lest they become offended. If I say something, it will not look well. If some of the trustees are not abiding by the principles, are not chanting 16 rounds, then they should be induced by the others who are following to step down. I think that you can follow what I mean. So anyway, just after that, that was the 7th of January, about a week later, Madhavisa actually flew to India from the South Seas to come and spend a few weeks with Srila Prabhupada. So on January the 18th, we were in Mayapur, and we were having a little discussion with Prabhupada in the evening. And Madhavisa was there, so he also asked a few managerial questions regarding ISKCON Fiji. Dayalji Punja, who was instrumental in establishing ISKCON there, is chanting the Maha Mantra and he's following the regulative principles. He is channeling money from his supermarket and other shops into building the Krishna temple. But meanwhile, he is still selling meat and liquor in the stores. So they had a family business, the Punjas. They had the biggest supermarket on the island. And of course they sold everything and anything. So there was a big section with meat and liquor and all these things. So it was kind of a bit disturbing, and Madhavisa didn't know, you know, what to do about it. He didn't know whether he should say something or not. So he expressed some uncertainty about whether to tell Dayalji to cease such sales or not. Prabhupada said that he should be allowed to continue and not be forced to give it up. He quoted Bhagavad Gita 18:48. Every endeavor is covered by some sort of fault, just as fire is covered by smoke. Therefore, one should not give up the work which is born of his nature, O son of Kunti, even if such work is full of fault. Prabhupada expressed confidence that if he is chanting Hare Krishna, then these things will soon be properly adjusted. And in fact, about 2 months later, without anybody saying anything, Dayalji decided that it was intolerable to have to, you know, make money from selling these things. And so he broke up the family business. And in India, you know, often you get these family businesses and it's almost sacrilegious, you know, to break away from the family tradition, you know, traditional business. And there were, I think, there were five brothers, I think, the Punjas. And, but Dayalji just decided, I can't make money from this kind of stuff anymore. So he broke the business up, he handed it over to his brothers, he took his share and he started up a prasadam restaurant business and ice cream parlors. So in that way then he got another income. So that was from the effects of chanting the holy name. It just automatically purified his heart so that on his own initiative, and therefore Prabhupada, you know, he said, no, you just, he's chanting, everything will be adjusted. He had that faith in the holy names, and that's exactly what happened. So January the 10th, 1976, we were in Bombay, and there was a letter that had come from Yasamadi Nandana Das. We had just been there actually the last week of December in Ahmedabad in Gujarat, and we'd gone to a small village called, a small town called Sanand, and Prabhupada had a Pandal program. So now Yasamadi Nandan was sending an update to Srila Prabhupada on what was happening in Ahmedabad. When the day that we had left there, he had taken Prabhupada to see a building which he thought might be good as a temple. So he sent an update on his attempts to secure a suitable center in Ahmedabad. The building he had taken Prabhupada to see had several defects, and since then he has located a much better place in the city center, but it is only available initially for a 3-month period. The owners are thinking of using it for some charitable cause, so Prabhupada encouraged him to accept it despite the time limit. He said, even if you can stay only 3 months, what is the loss? You can always look for another place. Now, people are seeing how genuine our movement is, and they are coming forward to offer us so many places. We simply have to maintain our strict principles, keeping ourselves pure. Otherwise, there are so many bogus institutions doing business in the name of God and simply cheating people. We have to be careful not to degenerate like these others. Our strength depends upon regular chanting the required 16 rounds and regularly adhering to the regulated principles. So, that was a strict standard. And Prabhupada said, this is the effect. If you keep pure, you keep chanting, then people will appreciate. They'll see there's a difference between the Krishna conscious man and the ordinary man, like that. So 16 rounds, that was the standard, but there were days when sometimes we didn't chant 16 rounds. It was a standard in those days that on a codices, everybody would chant 25 rounds. So on a morning walk in Mayapur, February the 11th, 1976, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, he'd come on as Prabhupada's secretary, so he asked Srila Prabhupada about the standards for chanting while observing a codice. So we should always chant 25 rounds on a codicil if initiated, he asked. Initiated? Everyone, Prabhupada said. Why initiated? So that should be the standard for our movement on a codicil day, Tamal asked. Standard is 16, Prabhupada said, but if we can chant more, then he is welcome. Tamal Krishna pressed to know if 25 was mandatory or not. When Jayapataka Maharaj suggested that it was recommended, Prabhupada seemed to disagree. No, ekadasi means that, fasting and chanting. However, when Tamal Krishna Maharaj referred to his man, and that at that time he was in charge of what was known as the Radha Damodar Travelling Sankirtan, he had 100 brahmacharis in about 6 greyhound buses, like this big bus that you have out here. He had six or eight of them, and about a dozen vans, and they were going all over America selling books. So he referred to his men going out in book distribution, and Prabhupada was quick to clarify, no, no, that is also preaching work. For that purpose, you can stop this 25 rounds. But generally, one who has no preaching work, then he can chant extra. So Prabhupada was willing, you know, to make adjustments as long as they did the 16 rounds. It didn't matter if they did the extra, if they were actually out actively preaching. But those who were not out preaching, then the recommendation that you do 25 on a codicil. So as he said, that 16 rounds was a little difficult. Prabhupada knew that. On April the 1st, 1976, we were in Vrindavan. And in the class, Prabhupada was reading from Srimad Bhagavatam 7.9.46, wherein Prahlad Maharaj speaks about Mona, or the vow of silence. In India, even today, people sometimes practice Mona, although generally it is not done for spiritual purposes, and neither is it strictly followed, as the practitioner often communicates with a small blackboard and chalk, or a pencil and paper, So the so-called Mona is not really, they don't speak, but they speak like this. And we had an experience of this actually when Prabhupada was in Chandigarh in October of 76. He was having a pandal there, and our devotees had been traveling in the north, and they met this man. He was a Mona Baba, and he had an ashram. So he kind of conveyed to the devotees that he would like to give his ashram to the ISKCON society, and then he would like to travel, you know, and engage in some preaching work. He's a Mona Baba. So anyway, he came to see Srila Prabhupada, and you know, he's sitting there in front of Prabhupada, and then somebody tells Prabhupada that this is, you know, such and such a Baba, and he's practicing Mona and he wants to give his ashram. And so Prabhupada said, well, what will he do? And then he said, well, he wants to go to America and preach. So Prabhupada laughed. He said, what preaching will you do? You don't say anything. So anyway, the point is that people sometimes do this, but he was the same thing. He had a little blackboard and a chalk, and he was writing down, you know, his replies. So-called not speaking. Therefore, Prabhupada said, there is no question of not talking. One must talk. But that talk should only be about Krishna. If all we talk about is mundane activities, then we should practice Mona. But for one who is preaching Krishna consciousness, there is never enough to be said. Srila Rupa Goswami says, I have only got one tongue and two ears. So how can I enjoy or serve Hare Krishna with only one tongue and two ears? If I had millions of ears and trillions of tongues, then it would be possible. So he is feeling like that. He is expecting so many ears and so many tongues to chant the Hare Krishna mantra. Then Prabhupada added, with perhaps a touch of irony, a comment relating to our present state of affairs. So far we are concerned, conditioned souls, even 16 rounds becomes very, very difficult job for us, because we are practiced to talk nonsense. We cannot find out little time, say for 2 hours, for chanting Hare Krishna, but we can find out 24 hours for talking nonsense. Therefore, one who cannot chant the Hare Krishna mantra, he should stop his talking. That is called Mona. Don't talk anymore. Better remain silent. This is recommendation by Prahlad Maharaj. So he concluded the class by saying that nowadays, no one can follow the strict practices mentioned in the scriptures. Therefore, he said, we should simply rely on the mercy of Lord Chaitanya and chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. So, of course, you can do more than 16, as he's already mentioned. And there was one devotee who had actually been a personal servant of Srila Prabhupada. And then in 1976, he began associating with some so-called Babajis in Radhakund and Govardhan. And he became infected with some ideas which set him at odds with Srila Prabhupada. And he ended up leaving the movement and rejecting Srila Prabhupada as his guru. So he had sent a letter to Srila Prabhupada explaining why he was leaving. Is there some water somewhere? And in that letter, one of his criticisms was that in the Shastra, it says that one should chant 1 lakh of names every day if we want to go back to Godhead. And that unless you chant 1 lakh of names every day, it's about 64 rounds, then you can't go back to Godhead in this life. So Prabhupada had come to Vrindavan. This is September the 9th. This man, Nittai Das, he had taken off, disappeared. And complaints were coming in about Nittai every day. Apparently he's been telling the devotees that it is not possible to go back to Godhead in this life unless one chants 100,000 names of Krishna, about 64 rounds every day. He has been claiming that if one only chants 16 rounds, it will take many births. Many devotees are affected by this nonsense, which Nittai got from some advanced devotee in Govardhan. Prabhupada said that he has become a Sahajya. He pointed out that at initiation, we agree to chant not less than 16 rounds. We are not saying only 16 rounds, Prabhupada said. You can chant more if you want, 64. But actually, we are not capable of chanting 64,000 names a day. This is not possible for you. So then, 3 days later, some more report came in. What had happened was that in August, when Prabhupada had arrived back from his last Western tour, we came into Bombay on August the 13th from Tehran. And Nittai was there in Bombay to meet Srila Prabhupada. And at that time, I thought that he looked very odd. He was kind of very pale, and he had no effulgence or brightness about him at all. I thought he was ill physically, but then later on I understood he wasn't ill physically, he was ill spiritually, because he was just on the verge of rejecting Srila Prabhupada. And he had come to see Prabhupada, but didn't let on that anything was wrong. So Prabhupada had given him 4,000 rupees, which was a lot of money in those days, to purchase some books for a proposed library that was to be set up in the new Bombay temple. So Bombay in those days, was the temple was just being constructed. It was kind of about halfway up at that particular time. Prabhupada had planned he was going to have a library there, and he would have books from all the different sampradayas, including Shankaracharya. And he would have, you know, those books there as a reference library. So Nittai was the one who was supposed to buy those books. He left Bombay and we never saw him again. So the money went also. So then when we got to Vrindavan, then we hear all this stuff about Nittai and how he's become, you know, affected. Then we get this letter from him where he basically, you know, he directly rejects Srila Prabhupada as his guru. And then a couple of days later, there was a friend of his that was on Mathura railway station. And he suddenly saw Nittai sitting in the railway coach. And it was the train to Jaipur. And the train was just about to leave. So he ran up to the window and said, "Nittai, what are you doing?" So then he said, "Well, I'm just going to Jaipur to say goodbye to Govinda." Because Radha Govinda, they're the main deities in Jaipur, famous deities. He said, "And then my wife has sent me a ticket and I'm going back to America." And then he suddenly pulled out this 4,000 rupees, passed it out the window of the train and said, "Here, Prabhupada gave me this to buy these books, so, you know, give it back." So Yogananda came back and gave the money to Prabhupada and made this report. So on September the 12th then, there was a discussion again on Nittai's departure again today. Prabhupada expressed strong displeasure about his propaganda that unless you chant 64 rounds daily, you cannot go back to Godhead in this life. "We don't mind if you chant 64 rounds," Prabhupada said. "That is good if you can do it. I never said only 16. 16 is the minimum. You must do that. But the difficulty is that some of them cannot even chant 16. So how will they do 64? If you can do 64, then do it. But why do you have to go to New York and chant 64? This is a reference. He got a ticket from his wife to go back to New York. "Why leave Vrindavan? Vrindavan is the best place to chant 64 rounds. But you are going to Jaipur to say goodbye to Govindaji. You rascal. Get out. You cannot stay here. That is Govindaji. Just to save this rascal from going to hell by his bad association, Krishna is forcing him to leave. Get out. You cannot stay here. It is Krishna's mercy that he is made to leave and give back the 4,000 rupees. 1 minute later, he would have been missed on the railway station and he would have kept that money. It was Krishna's arrangement." So that was Prabhupada's comment on Nittai. He wanted to chant 60. He's complaining, "In ISKCON, we don't chant 64 rounds." Now he's leaving. But then he gets a ticket, he's going back to New York. Why go to New York? You can stay in Vrindavan. That's the best place to chant 64 rounds. And no, he's going back to New York to join his wife. And of course, what happened to him is practically became like an atheist. He's still criticizing Srila Prabhupada. He became a professor at some university in America, Sanskrit or something like that. But I saw on his website a few years ago, he had a little kind of biography of himself, autobiography. And he said there that previously he had, you know, joined the Krishna consciousness movement. Bhaktivedanta Swami was his guru, but then later on, you know, he went off somewhere else. And like this. And then he, in the next paragraph, he says, sometimes I think about, you know, all these stories about Krishna and like that. This is all just some imagination. He said, and then sometimes I think, no, maybe there's something to it. So this is a man who was previously Prabhupada's personal servant. But because he offended his guru, then he fell down to this position where he thinks Krishna is just an imagination. Now he's, you know, saying things like that Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita is no good. So he's going to personally write the proper version of the Bhagavad Gita. This is a man who doesn't practically even believe in Krishna. So puffed up. But anyway, that's what happens to you if you mix with the wrong people. And Prabhupada was always very careful to tell us not to mix with, you know, the so-called Babajis in Govardhan or Radhakund or, you know, in the Vrindavan area, because many of them, they're just bogus. And they have all these concocted ideas. And they just blaspheme the genuine Vaishnavas, that's all. So anyway, he came to an unfortunate end. Now, there was one devotee who was chanting more than 16 rounds. In fact, he was chanting more than 64 rounds. He was chanting 150 rounds. So you'll see what Prabhupada said about that one. Because he just said there, if you want to chant more than 16, then do it, if you can do it. So on February the 25th, Prabhupada, in 76, Prabhupada was in Mayapur. And the conversation turned to Sharmadas, who was an American devotee who had come here after serving in Africa. Disturbed by misbehavior and poor standards there, he came to Vrindavan to see Srila Prabhupada late last year, saying that he only wanted to chant Hare Krishna. So Prabhupada had allowed him to come here to Mayapur. So at present, he is living in the Gaushala, chanting 150 rounds a day and eating only the remnants of foodstuffs left by the other devotees. Recently, he came to see Srila Prabhupada to get permission to build a tree hut to live in so that he could avoid seeing anyone. He complained that he was being disturbed in his chanting because devotees would come to see him and interrupt him. But Prabhupada condemned his idea, which he said was living like a monkey up in the trees. He said that Sharma's so-called renunciation was actually only another form of sense gratification. It was also based on selfish interest, even if it was only a small display of it. He gave the example of two thieves, one who steals a diamond and the other one who steals a cucumber. So he said, just because one is stealing only in a small way, it does not mean that he is not a thief. Jayapataka Swami asked if Grihastha life was meant for the one who steals cucumbers. Prabhupada laughed. He said, yes, Krishna is giving allowance for stealing cucumbers. Prabhupada conceded that Sharma, at least, wasn't doing anything bad. But he said that active service is better. Prabhupada is not displeased with him because something is better than nothing. And he has allowed him to stay here because if he leaves, he may end up going elsewhere to practice something other than Krishna consciousness. So that was February the 25th. So on March the 8th, Sharmadas came over from his hideaway at the Gaushala at 4 p.m. to see Srila Prabhupada with a request to leave Mayapur. He wants to go and chant in Radhakund. With so many devotees here now for the festival, he complained that he is again being disturbed in his chanting. Prabhupada told him that this indicated that his mind is restless. Previously, he had asked to live in a tree, and now Radhakund. You are not fit for Nirjana Bhajan, Prabhupada told him. This is for the Maha Bhagwats like Thakur Haridas, who are completely undisturbed. Haridas Thakur lived in a cave with a large snake but he was not perturbed. He added that if one's mind is even a little disturbed, then nirjana bhajan will not be possible. After this meeting, Sharma Prabhu later told Pushtakrishna Swami, who was the secretary, that he had decided to return to Africa and preach. And Prabhupada was pleased to hear this. So that was March the 8th. September the 27th, 1976, Prabhupada was back in Vrindavan. And he received a letter from Sharmadas, which was sent from Africa. So he'd been there for some time. He did actually go there. But then in this letter, he again requested permission to make chanting his main service, saying that he didn't want to act whimsically and he only wanted to please Srila Prabhupada. He declared, "We have no love for Krishna, but we have this attraction to serve Krishna as a servant of the confidential serving maids of Krishna. By your mercy, we understand that we cannot go to Vrindavan by any ticket. So we are, by the grace of Krishna, trying to fix our mind on this service in Vrindavan. This fixing of the mind is dependent on my chanting Krishna names. And my chanting Krishna names is simply dependent on your mercy, because my god brothers do not like me chanting. We do not want to commit offenses to our god brothers. Yet sometimes when I tell them that I only want to hear about Krishna in Vrindavan, or the glories of his holy name or qualities, some say we must talk of other things. They are more pure than my sinful self. As far as this living entity, he only wants to hear or talk about Krishna. My god brothers, as far as I am concerned, are better and more advanced. But because of my sinful condition, if you would allow me to chant these few extra rounds, read your books, and render some small service, maybe before leaving this body, Krishna will allow this sinful entity to be elevated to the position of one of his loving servants. It is our only desire to have our devotional kripa take shelter of Goloka Vrindavan and to somehow or another please our spiritual master and Krishna." Prabhupada's reply to him was quite terse. "So, why did you leave Mayapur if you were so expert in chanting? Read my books and do some menial service, but why have you left Mayapur? You were restless, so what can be done? You were chanting in Mayapur. Wherever you may live, you have to abide by the order of the authority. Because you were restless, you were not fit for chanting absolutely." So he expressed some apparently nice sentiments. But it's evident, at least to me, from this letter that Sharma wrote, that he had actually picked up some of this Sahaja stuff in Vrindavan. This process that some of the Babajis adopt, it's actually meant for very, very elevated personalities, where they meditate on the different pastimes of Krishna at different times of the day. And they sing bhajans according to the particular pastimes that are going on during that part of the day. So, what is that? Astakalya Leela. Like this. But this is like, it's for very, very advanced souls. But it's imitated a lot by, you know, so-called Babajis. And they sit there, they smoke bidis, they have girlfriends, and at the same time they make a show of chanting and, you know, thinking of Krishna's leelas. So from the mood of his letter there, Sharma's letter, it sounds like he's expressing a little bit of this, that I only want about, you know, think about Krishna's pastimes. I just want to be the servant of the serving maids, blah, blah, blah. I just want to chant Hare Krishna. But Prabhupada's, you know, take on that is that your mind is simply restless, that's all. You can't fix yourself on anything properly, and therefore you're not fit for this kind of service. What happened to Sharma, I have no idea. I never heard from him again or about him since we got that letter. I don't know where he is. Anyway, there was another devotee who had been given permission by Srila Prabhupada to just chant Hare Krishna as his service. His name was Odalami. In 1975, he had been told by his doctor that now you only have a few months left to live. You're very seriously ill, and you're going to die within a few months. So he took that very seriously. He went to Srila Prabhupada, And he asked Srila Prabhupada for permission to take Babaji initiation. Because Prabhupada had been giving sannyas initiation as well as regular initiation. But nobody had ever been given Babaji initiation. And in fact, to be a Babaji was not really looked upon as being very, you know, conducive if you wanted to be in the Krishna consciousness movement, because Prabhupada always stressed preaching was our, you know, main business. And that to be a Ghostianandi was more elevated than to be a Bhajananandi. So the Babajis are Bhajananandis. But anyway, because this boy kind of pushed, and, you know, because of his condition, Prabhupada agreed to give him Babaji initiation. It was the only one that he ever did. And I think around about July the 5th, he was initiated, 1975, as a Babaji, and he became Odalami Babaji Maharaj. And he went off to Mayapur so that he could spend his last days there in the Dham just chanting. So 6 months or 7 months later, Prabhupada arrived in Mayapur. And then, of course, he asked, where is Odalami Maharaj? And he wasn't there anymore. So Prabhupada mentioned on the February the 4th, Prabhupada mentioned another wayward disciple named Odalami, who had been told by doctors that he would die within a few months. He had been asked to get, he had asked to be given Babaji initiation, and Prabhupada had reluctantly agreed, and thus Odalami Maharaj came to spend his last days in Mayapur chanting Hare Krishna. But when another doctor informed him that he would not die so soon, he returned to his wife in the USA, gave up devotional service, and became like a kami again. He was last seen surfing off the west coast. So, therefore, Prabhupada's point was proved that unless you actually have, you know, a peaceful mind and fixed, you're not fit to chant all day long. You can't do it. You know, it will, you'll be ruined actually by it. It's a very elevated stage to get to this point of nirjana bhajan. It's not an easy thing. So therefore, Prabhupada always stressed that you must simply work very hard. Work first, samadhi later. That was one of our mantras. Yeah, work first, samadhi later. In other words, you work hard, purify yourself, do as much service as you can, and then later, when you get older and more advanced, then maybe the question will come about, you know, retiring and just chanting. But that will, you know, it's an elevated position. So, let's see. Yes, and there was a conversation actually that we had where Prabhupada again stressed this point about being active. On October the 9th, 1976, Prabhupada had gone to Aligarh. Aligarh is a town, small city, just next to Vrindavan, actually. It's about 1 hour's drive. There was a man there, his name was Surendra Kumar Saigal. He was the owner of a lock company. They made brass locks, Tiger Lock Company. So he was a very wealthy man, and we had done a program at his house, or in Aligarh, at the end of March in 1976. He invited Prabhupada to come back, and he arranged for all of his wealthy friends and influential people in Aligarh to come and listen to Srila Prabhupada speak at, on the grounds of his own house for 2 days, the 9th and 10th of October. So Prabhupada was chit-chatting in the afternoon. He was sitting out on the lawn. We were having a little kind of informal darshan. So Prabhupada was laughing along with his audience, and he returned to his point. As everyone can be raised to the platform of Krishna consciousness, he said, there is no difficulty. This is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement. So from early in the morning, he is teaching Udila Aruna Puravabhagi Dwijamani Gaura Amani Jagi. When the rising sun appeared in the east, the jewel of the twice-born Lord Gaurasundra awakened. So he was not lazy. He was very busy from early in the morning. So if we at least pretend to follow Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we cannot sleep. We must rise early in the morning. One must get up at least 1.5 hours before the sunrise. That is the Mangal Arati. Mangal Arati means get up early in the morning, take your bath, and be prepared for the Mangal Arati. Then you begin your chanting, prayer. So this is activity. He told us about an exchange that he had had in the 1940s with a man who had challenged him that Vaishnavas were lazy fellows. He chuckled as he recounted the conversation. So I said, "You have never seen a Vaishnav." "No, I have seen these Vaishnavs. They do not do anything, and taking mala and pretending to be very highly elevated and sleep and snore. But you have not seen. You might have seen these pseudo Vaishnavs, but the real Vaishnav you have not seen." "Oh, what is that real Vaishnav?" And I said that in India there were two big wars. One war was Ram Ravana, and another was Kurukshetra. So in these two wars, the hero is a Vaishnav. One is Hanuman, and the other is Arjuna. So have you seen them? Have you heard about them? Are they lazy fellows? Hanuman is a Vaishnav. He could raise one mountain and jump over the sea and then set fire in the very beautiful state of Ravana. This is Vaishnav. And Arjuna, he was in the beginning hesitating that, "Oh, my cousin brothers, the other side." But then he decided, "Yes, I shall fight." Krishna had inquired from him, "Now I have instructed you. Now whatever you like, you can do. And what is your decision?" So he clearly said, "Yes, my decision is there. I shall fight. Karishye vachanam tava. As you advise, I understand that you want this fighting." So Vaishnav means, for the sake of Krishna, he can do anything. Not that he is a lazy fellow, showing, "Oh, I have become a very big Vaishnav. Let me sleep under the name of chanting Hare Krishna." Faithful servant means always alert, and that is bhakti. Anukulyena Krishnanu Shilanam Bhaktir Uttama. Simply, one has to execute anukulyena, how Krishna is satisfied. This is bhakti. So Prabhupada stressed that neither Hanuman, a monkey, nor Arjuna, a warrior, were told by the Lord to give up their occupational duties to sleep and snore and become a great devotee. No, he never says. He says, "You are attached to this kind of work, all right, you do it. But the result you give to me, this is bhakti. Arjuna, you are a military man, all right, I ask you to fight. You become a fighter, and you become my devotee. Bhaktosi priyosi me." Just see. What is that? He was not chanting Hare Krishna. But Krishna says, "Bhaktosi priyosi me. You are a very dear friend and my devotee." So Prabhupada made it clear that he wasn't speaking against sitting down and chanting. But one has to be qualified to do that. Of course, ultimate is to always be absorbed in glorifying the Lord, Prabhupada told us. But not in the beginning. In the beginning, you must work very hard. You come to the stage of pure devotional platform. Then you can fully engage yourself in meditation or chanting. But not in the beginning. In the beginning, you should be very expert and active. That is wanted. That is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Udilo. From early in the morning. Active. Come on, chant. Come with me so that others will see. If we make a party chanting Hare Krishna, so in the beginning they may be disturbed because they have become accustomed to sleep up until 9 o'clock. But as they will hear, gradually they will be purified and they will receive it. So, in the beginning you have to be very expert and active. Later on you can chant. And as Prabhupada said this, sitting and sleeping. I had a practical example of that, unfortunately. When we got to Bombay in 1975, I'd been on the party about 3 weeks, and it was taking me a little bit to adjust, you know, to the fact of being constantly in close proximity to Srila Prabhupada, and especially when I had to chant my rounds in the morning, because I'm one of those people, if I don't chant loudly, then, you know, I don't do it nicely. So I have to chant loudly and I kind of get into a rhythm. But I couldn't do that whilst I was with Prabhupada because you were always in the room next to him. Actually, when we had gone to Vrindavan at the beginning of December, and I was, you know, the first day that I was told that I was now Prabhupada's regular servant, Prabhupada gave me my first direct instruction. We had gone up on the roof after he had had his lunch, and there was a room there, and he went in the room to take his afternoon rest. He used to sleep 1 hour after lunch. And then he turned round, there was a mat on the floor outside the door, and he said, "So now," he said, "you stay there." He said, "Now your only business is to be with me 24 hours. So that was my first instruction that I got from Prabhupada. So that's what I did. I was there all the time. That's what the servant's duty was. You had to always be on call. So in Bombay, when we got there, there wasn't actually enough room in Prabhupada's quarters for the servant to stay there. So we were staying in the flat right next to it. What the situation there was that when Prabhupada bought that Juhu Beach land, there were actually six buildings, two-story buildings, composed of, I think, like three or four flats on each floor in each building. And they were all occupied by, you know, just ordinary people. They had tenants and they had leases, and we couldn't ask them to leave until the leases expired. So there was nowhere for the devotees to stay. Not one of those flats was available. So what Prabhupada did was he had a builder come, and Mr. P.L. Sethi, and he built an extra floor on the top of each building. And then the devotees occupied those top floors, third floor. So one building was reserved for Srila Prabhupada. So he had one small flat, and there was when you entered, there was a small reception area, very small, and there was a toilet and a sink outside that. And then going off from there, there was one room that went to the right that was into a small darshan room. There was another room that went off behind that into Prabhupada's bedroom, and there was another door that led into the kitchen. So in the morning time, we were staying in the flat next to Prabhupada's. I would come in at 5 o'clock and then sit in the reception room and wait for Srila Prabhupada to come out from, you know, his workroom where he'd been translating during the night. And I'd sit there and I'd try and chant my japa. So of course, you know, I sat chanting and sat nodding and like that. I sat nodding out. So then Prabhupada came out from his room to, you know, brush his teeth in the sink, and I'm completely out. I'm sitting there, my head's down, I've got my hand in my bead bag, but I'm fast asleep. And then Prabhupada saw me, so he woke me up. And of course I was very embarrassed that I hadn't seen Prabhupada come into the room. And, you know, Prabhupada told me, he said, "Do not sit while you are chanting. Sitting means sleeping." So that was it. After that time, then I, you know, always made an effort to keep standing up once I chant. I have the same problem even now. I sit down, I sleep, that's it. And I always remember when I was a new bhakta, it was one of the favorite occupations of the temple commander in the Sydney temple. When everybody was chanting japa in the morning, we would always, you know, sit around the temple room like you are now, and he would walk around, and every now and again you would hear this whack, and he'd hit somebody over the head with his bead bag to wake them up. So it's a common thing, we all know it, but sitting means sleeping. If you remember that mantra before you chant your japa, then you'll be all right, you'll be able to stay awake. So, and again, you know, more examples of sitting down and not chanting. April the 8th, 1976, we were in Vrindavan. So in class, Prabhupada explained to us what is required if we want to please Krishna and get his blessings. "We have to surrender," he said. "That will please Krishna. And without pleasing him, you cannot see Krishna. You may have your eyes, big, big eyes, but you cannot see Krishna. You have to please him. And that pleasing activity is bhakti. Without that bhakti, it means sitting down silently. No, no, I'm chanting. I don't want to go out. I'm busy. This means excuse. What will you chant? You will think of money and women. That's all. Just work. Go and sell books and work hard. That is wanted. Therefore, we do not give that opportunity. My Guru Maharaj did not give this opportunity, and we are following the same principle. No opportunity of sitting idle. No, you must work. That will rectify you. Yes. So Prabhupada knew it's an excuse. No, no, I'm chanting japa. I'm sorry, Prabhu, I can't clean the floor. I'm sorry, Prabhu, I can't go out and sell books. I'm chanting. Prabhupada knew it's all an excuse. So anyway, the tendency is when you sit down, then you fall asleep. But there was one occasion, I had one experience where I was actually able to conquer sleep by chanting. And that was during Prabhupada's evening massage. Now, when I first joined Prabhupada's party in Bengali markets in Delhi in late November of 75, I was told by Upendra Prabhu, who was his servant at that time, to report to Prabhupada's room at 9 o'clock. Upendra was leaving the next day to go to Fiji to do some preaching. So I had been asked to fill in as Prabhupada's masseur, and I'd never done it before in my whole life. So I had to go there at noontime and go up on the roof and watch Upendra as he massaged Prabhupada. And then I was told to come back at 9 o'clock at night. So when I came back, then I discovered that Prabhupada actually had an evening massage, which I didn't know up until that time. I'd been in the movement, I think, about just over 3.5 years. I knew about the noontime massage because we'd seen pictures of Prabhupada and I'd seen Prabhupada get massaged by Shrutakirti Prabhu when he came to Melbourne. But I didn't know about this evening massage. So I went in at 9 o'clock. Prabhupada was sitting at his desk. He was having his hot milk. And then after about half an hour, then he stood up and he said, "All right, let's go." So then he went off into the bedroom and Upendra signaled to me to follow. So we went into the bedroom. Prabhupada laid down, put the lights out. Then Upendra stood next to him and began to massage up and down his legs from the thighs, calves, and feet. And also Prabhupada's left hip used to sometimes suffer from numbness from sitting down all day. Then the circulation naturally wasn't that good. So that would help to keep his circulation up, that evening massage. So Prabhupada would lay down and, you know, go to sleep. And then you'd have to keep, you know, massage him. So Upendra told me, he said, "The first time that I did this service, Prabhupada started to, you know, snore. He went to sleep and he was snoozing. So I thought, oh, Prabhupada's sleeping, so I'll stop now." So he said, I was just going out. I just got to the door. And then Prabhupada's voice came out from the darkness. "Oh, you were finished?" So then he said, I had to come back and keep on going until he told me that I could leave. So he said, if Prabhupada goes to sleep, you have to keep on going. You can't leave until he tells you. So that first night, it was 10 minutes. And then Prabhupada was lying there and just went, "Hmm." And that was it. That was the signal. You could go. So off we went. So I thought, well, that's a really easy service, you know. Then 4 months later, we got to Mayapur. And then I found that, you know, that evening massage had gone from 10 minutes up to about half an hour. And then it went from half an hour to 1 hour. And then it went from 1 hour to 1.5 hours. And then there were a few nights when it actually was 2 hours. And, you know, you can imagine what it was like. I've given a description anyway, March the 1st. Evening massage is also becoming difficult to perform. It has been getting increasingly longer each night. Every evening after the pujaris fumigate Prabhupada's bedroom with incense smoke to drive out the mosquitoes, Anaka Dundavi Das and I drape a very large net around Prabhupada's bed, mosquito net. When Prabhupada lies down to take rest at about 10 p.m., the lights go out. I slip under the net and perch cross-legged at his side on the bed to massage up and down his legs and feet as he softly slumbers. Previously, the massage lasted between half an hour and 45 minutes, but here in Mayapur, the sessions have been going on for an hour or longer. Tonight, it went on for 2 hours, over 2 hours, the longest ever, and I left Prabhupada's room just after midnight. I find it very difficult to sit in the dark, sweating under the mosquito net, breathing air thick with incense smoke, with no breeze for relief, and not a sound save Srila Prabhupada's soft snoring. It is difficult to stay awake on the job. Occasionally I do drift off, only to snap suddenly back to consciousness without knowing how long I've been out. So sometimes you'd be massaging away, Prabhupada would go to sleep, and then, you know, you get the nods again. And then you'd nod out, and then suddenly wake up, and you wouldn't know whether you'd been out for 5 seconds, or 5 minutes, or 15 minutes, or... And Prabhupada would still be, you know, sleeping, and then you'd have to keep on going again. So it was a little difficult. So it was becoming a big problem for me, and it was proving to be the toughest service of the day, because you'd already been up from 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and then, you know, by 10, 11 o'clock at night, everybody else was asleep. So there was no sound anywhere, there was no lights anywhere, and you're just there, just you and your mind, you know. So it was getting quite tough, and I was trying to figure out how to stop falling asleep whilst I was doing this service. So this particular night, by Krishna's grace, I was able to stay awake by chanting slokas within my mind. I remembered that in the Gita, Krishna had called Arjuna Gudakesh, conqueror of sleep. So my little experience is giving me a glimpse of what a high degree of sense control is required to earn the title of Gudakesh. So that's how I did it. In those days, I actually knew some Sanskrit mantras. Nowadays, I've forgotten most of them, but I think I knew about 150 or 200 slokas in those days. So I just decided tonight I'm going to just chant all the slokas that I know. So I just kept on chanting all these slokas, and that was how I kept awake. But that was the only night that I managed to do it. The rest of the time it was back to the nods. So anyway, so that's a little bit about sleeping, sitting and sleeping, and chanting Hare Krishna. Is there any questions or comments up to this point? Yes, Manaji.
Yes, you mentioned that Prabhupada took his hot milk in the evening. Did he take like every evening hot milk?
Yeah. Okay, I'll just say a little bit about Prabhupada's schedule so that you have an idea what used to go on. It's a little bit off the topic, but... you know, it's nice to know how Prabhupada lived his days. In one sense, Prabhupada didn't have a beginning and an end of his day. You know, it's like Krishna's pastimes, when they're beginning in one, you know, they're ending in one place, they're beginning in another. They're kind of just eternally going on. So Prabhupada's day and nights were all like that. But I'll start, you know, early in the morning at dawn. So Prabhupada would, you know, he would be up all night translating. At Mangalarati time, then he would stop. When the devotees would begin to go for Mangalarati, then Prabhupada would stop doing his translation work. He would chant, or he would sometimes have a little snooze. And then he would go into the bathroom, he would clean up, freshen up, brush his teeth, wash his face. And then he would get ready for his morning walk. He would put on his fresh tilak, chant his morning Gayatri, and then we would go out just at the crack of dawn on an hour's walk. And then after his walk, he would come back, go into the temple, he would greet the deities, receive Guru Puja, and then he would give the Bhagavatam class. After that, then he would go back to his rooms, and then he would have his breakfast. Breakfast was usually whatever fresh fruits that were available, nicely cut up, and also peeled. Prabhupada never ate the peels. Apples, you had to peel them. Then also with the fruits, sometimes he liked fresh fried cashew nuts, just lightly browned, fried in ghee. Sometimes he would have muri, puffed rice, like a bowl of hot puffed rice, and maybe a little bit of sandesh. So that was general for the morning. And I observed that he would not begin his breakfast without first taking a few slices of ginger. So ginger root soaked in lemon juice. So he'd have a couple of pieces of that just to kickstart his digestion. Then he would eat his breakfast. After breakfast, then he would sit for maybe 15 to 20 minutes in his room, or he would chant a couple of rounds, walk up and down and chant a couple of rounds. Then he would go and he would take rest for about an hour. So that was his first rest period of the day. Then after taking rest, he would get up maybe about 10 o'clock or 10:30. And if there were any special visitors, usually they were invited to come at that time, and Prabhupada would meet with them. Or if there were no visitors, then he would often have the secretary come in and he would deal with whatever mail that there was that morning. Then at 11:30, then he would take his massage. So the massage would last about an hour and a half. And that was two different kinds of oil. Sandalwood oil for his head, because sandalwood has cooling properties. And as Prabhupada said, to be Krishna conscious, you have to be cool-headed. So he used to have sandalwood oil on his head. And then the rest of his body, then that would be mustard oil. So that would take about an hour and a half. And then after that, Prabhupada would bathe. Then he would put fresh clothing on. Then he would sit down, chant his Gayatri, put fresh tilak on. And then the cook would serve lunch at 1:30. For lunch, the general standard, minimum standard, was a bowl of rice, two dry sabjis, two wet sabjis, and then some kind of sweet, and dal. And then, of course, chapatis. So the chapatis had to be fresh. So one fresh chapati would be on the plate when we brought the plate in for Prabhupada when he sat down. Then when he needed another one, he would ring a bell, and then we would put another chapati on the flames, puff it up, and then run in and drop that on Prabhupada's plate. And usually he would take maybe about three or four chapatis. So that way then lunch would take about half an hour or so. Then again he would kind of sit for 10 minutes, 15 minutes just to let things start to digest. And then again he would take another 1 hour's rest. So after that afternoon rest he would get up maybe about between 3:30 and 4 o'clock. He never used an alarm clock, Prabhupada. He would just take rest and then wake up at the right time. That was it. It's like he had an inbuilt alarm. He always knew when the right time was to wake up. So then at 4 o'clock, when he got up, then we would give him a cup of fresh fruit juice. Or if they were available, we would give him some coconut juice, dub. And then a flower garland, and we would put sandalwood paste on his forehead as well. Then from probably about 4:30 till 6 o'clock or 6:30, then he would give darshan, open darshan. Anybody would come and sit down and they could ask questions. Prabhupada would, you know, reply. Then at the evening arati, then he would send everybody out to attend the arati. Then he would either meet with, you know, the temple managers, or he would sit and chant for a while. And then in the evening time, same thing for a couple of hours. He was always meeting with somebody. Somebody would turn up, or he would call for the GBCs or sannyasis or whatever, and he would discuss various things to do with the temple management. Then at about 9:30 usually, that's when he would take a cup of hot milk. So he had that hot milk every night. The only time that I can remember when he didn't take it, when I was with him at least, was when he was not feeling very well when we were in Mayapur. And for a few nights, instead of taking hot milk, he was having a half a rasgulla. Because in Bengal is famous for rasgullas. If you ever want to know what a rasgulla is, you don't know what a rasgulla is until you've had one from Bengal. They're expert. So Prabhupada would have half a rasgulla. And he told me, he said, I'm taking my milk without taking milk. You know, rasgulla, because it's a milk sweet. So then, after he had his milk, then about 10 o'clock time, then he would take rest. So we would go in, we would, if we were in India especially, we'd set up the mosquito net and everything. And then Prabhupada would go in, he would lie down, and then he would take this evening massage. And as I've said, that would vary the length of time, how long that took. Sometimes it was very quick, sometimes it was a long time. So then, once Prabhupada had told me to stop doing the massage, then I would go back into his sitting room and make sure that everything was set up ready for his translation work. Then I'd go and take rest. Prabhupada would come out. Sometimes he would come out practically immediately after, you know, I'd stopped giving him his massage. Sometimes he would sleep for maybe an hour more. But generally speaking, that evening rest was again about 1 to 2 hours, not more than that. And then he would get up, he would come in, he would sit down, and then he would begin his translation work. And that translation work would go on, you know, throughout the night up until Mangalarati time. So that was the general schedule. So yeah, that, you know, the milk was there, that was a regular feature. And Prabhupada liked his milk very hot. Not too hot. That was one thing that Prabhupada showed me when I first joined his party, was how to get the milk to the right temperature. Because I brought it in one, I'd heated up the milk and I brought it in and it was very, very hot and he couldn't drink it. So then he said, you didn't, you know, cool it. So I was kind of blank. I didn't know how to cool milk down properly. So then he said, bring a bowl. So I brought a bowl and then he held the bowl and he took the cup and he held it up in the air and he poured the milk from the bowl, from the cup into the bowl. And then he held the bowl up and he poured it back down and like this. He was going like this, pouring the milk. Didn't spill a drop. And then, you know, when he got it to the right temperature, then he drank it. So that was simple. So, milk. And sometimes in the evening, Prabhupada would also have like a little snack. Maybe paratha or a kachori, something like that. And that would, you know, give him some energy, strength for the night, for translating his books. So, all right. Any other questions? Yes, Brahma.
So, as far as understood, Prabhupada didn't chant the Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya between the orchidit. What's your between the rounds?
That will come up, this business of chanting the Panchatattva mantra. That's one of the sections. We'll come to that in a little while. So I won't answer that right now. Any other questions at this point? Yes, Bruno.
I heard that he was taking something to wake up, to be awake.
And what, like Prozac or something?
Something we should not take.
No, sometimes Prabhupada suffered from high blood pressure. So one of the remedies for relieving that, because high blood pressure, and it affects your sinuses and your whole mucus system as well. So sometimes to relieve that, Prabhupada would sniff snuff. Snuff is powdered tobacco. I remember my grandfather always was sniffing snuff. It's like a brownish powder, and you put it on the on your back of your hand, and like that goes up, and it clears your sinuses and everything. So sometimes they would have snuff, and we used to carry a couple of little tins with us. And yeah, sometimes I'd come in the morning, and I'd see on the end of Prabhupada's dhoti some snuff where he'd, you know, wipe the excess off with the tip of his dhoti. I guess that's what you're referring to there. Yeah. Yeah. But normally it's not recommended to take snuff. But for medicinal purposes, there are things that we wouldn't normally take that can be taken. You know, in Ayurvedic medicine, there's sometimes there are animal products and things like that, or they use alcohol as a base. When I got sick with some boils once. I had a boil on my leg and I came into Prabhupada's room and I was limping. And I hadn't said anything, but Prabhupada noticed that I was limping and he asked me, you know, what's the problem? So I showed him I had a big boil on my leg. So he immediately called Jaipataka Swami, because we were in Calcutta. And then he said, you go out and you buy some Saribadi salsa. It's a blood purifier. So he came back with this bottle of Saribadi salsa. I took that for a few days and the boil went away. It fixed it up. And I think that has some percentage of like an alcohol base in it. It's not drinking alcohol, but it's the medicinal alcohol. But, you know, you can get drunk on that stuff if you drink enough of it. But as a medicine, you can take it. And in fact, one time when we were in New Brindavan in June of 76, Prabhupada was walking along the road and he saw different herbs, you know, growing at the side of the road, just wild. So he commented on that and he said that there are men who, you know, they're expert in herbs. They go and they gather up these herbs wherever they're growing and they make medicines from them. And he mentioned that there's, now what's it called? Gritus something or other. There's some Ayurvedic medicine which is made by throwing a live goat into boiling ghee. And then they make some product from that. And that's supposed to cure some serious disease like tuberculosis or something. So, you know, there are products sometimes for medicinal purposes that you can take that you wouldn't normally take. But medicine is a whole different thing. Yes?
In that book which you mentioned before, it is described that Prabhupada invented one medicine which is still sold in India. I don't know if you came across to these medicines. Do you remember anything about that?
What is that medicine?
I don't know, something for getting better, more energy in the body, some vitamins, something like that.
Well, yeah, Prabhupada did. He did know about medicine. He was a pharmacist. And he sometimes made up, you know, his own tonics. In fact, there's a story that Dr. Kapoor, who was one of Prabhupada's godbrothers, told me that in the 1930s... now, how does it go? Prabhupada had made a tonic and then Dr. Kapoor had asked Srila Prabhupada, why don't you give me the tonic that you're taking? Then he said, what tonic is that? Then he said, the tonic that makes you, you know, give you love of Godhead. So then, you know, Prabhupada told him, he said, I don't have that tonic, but he said, I know the formula. He said, and I shall preach it all over the world. And this was in the 1930s when, you know, there was no talk at that time of Prabhupada going overseas. But Prabhupada told him, I know that tonic and I shall, the formula, and I shall preach it all over the world. So, I don't know what other tonics there are. But it's the fact that Prabhupada was selling liniments, day's liniment for rheumatism and things like this. And there were other things that he, you know, he made up as a pharmacist. He knew what ingredients to combine together. And he also knew about all the bogus stuff that was going on in medicine as well. He told us that once. He says, I know what they do. They just take some, you know, chemical and then they mix it a little bit this way. They give it some very long, unpronounceable name. And then they advertise, oh, new wonder medicine. They're all... Prabhupada didn't have very much good opinion about the medical industry as a whole. Any other questions? So what time do you want me to finish? Now, I can go as long as you want, but it's up to you. You have to tell me. You were saying that an earlier finish is better, but now it's 5 to 8. So let's do a little bit more, a few more minutes. Okay. So chanting is a common platform for resolving conflicts. As Prabhupada had mentioned in that leaflet that he first put out when he went to the West, all the difficulties of modern life can be resolved on the platform of chanting. And Prabhupada encouraged his devotees always, you know, to try to resolve their differences by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. So on March the 4th, 1976, when Prabhupada was in Mayapur in 76, there were two conflicts that were going on. One of them was a long-standing conflict. There was a group of disciples that had broken away from ISKCON. They were being led by a sannyasi called Siddhaswarupananda. And they had split away from ISKCON in 1973 and made their own faction. And they were criticizing ISKCON for various reasons. They had some disagreements about our book distribution and various other things. They didn't like deity worship, etc., etc. But they were interested in chanting. So Mayapur Festival, Siddhaswarup actually turned up there with a couple of his men. And naturally, you know, there was some kind of agitation, a little bit going on. Prabhupada thought it was a good opportunity to try to resolve some of the difficulties if he were there personally. So I took the opportunity during one of the massages on March the 4th on his massage to, to ask Srila Prabhupada about this particular group. Because I had joined in Australia, and when this group left, they were based in New Zealand, Australia, and Hawaii. And we lost an entire temple. They just walked out and left the temple, Brisbane Temple. We had about 25 devotees, and then the next day everybody had gone to, you know, go off with Siddhaswarup in Hawaii, and there was nothing left. And the Auckland Temple was the same. They lost about 18 or 20 men, and there were only two people left. So it was a, you know, kind of a serious thing. And we were always having, you know, interactions with this group, unfriendly interactions. So I thought this is a good opportunity to ask Srila Prabhupada what his opinion is of these people. Because they always claim that, no, Prabhupada, you know, approves of us. And we always were saying, no, you're not approved, you know, you're not in ISKCON, and that's it. So I asked Prabhupada, and although between his disciples there seemed to be major differences preventing cooperative action, Prabhupada smilingly gave his own perspective on the two camps. Of course, I have my affection for them. I don't send them away, and they are coming to see me. Just like there may be so many animals, so some are a little fiercer than the others. Prabhupada's perspective on us. He also pointed out that they are coming to us, not us to them. Prabhupada always refers to ISKCON as us. He said that there are differences, just as there are between him and his own God brothers, but that we share the common platform of chanting Hare Krishna and taking prasadam. I mentioned that in New Zealand, our men discouraged Siddhaswarup's people from visiting the temple. But Prabhupada said, why? They can come. Our centers are only for this purpose, to chant Hare Krishna and to take prasadam. Gradually they will come to sense. Later on in May, when we were in Hawaii, that was Siddhaswarup's base, so he again came to see Srila Prabhupada. So we were in Prabhupada's room, this is May the 9th, late in the afternoon when Siddhaswarup Maharaj came in. He sat in front of Prabhupada's desk, leaning on the corner with his elbow, quite casually, I thought. Prabhupada pleasantly asked him, so, what is the difference between the two groups? It was an indication that if there were any differences between ISKCON and Siddha's group, why not, while he is here, work to clear them up so that everyone can cooperate? Siddhaswarup simply lowered his head, his bottom lip protruding, and ignored the overture. Well, Prabhupada, he pouted, I think Krishna will decide who's right and who's wrong. That was... He seems completely negative to any proposal for cooperation, even from his own spiritual master. Over the last few days, Prabhupada has been requesting the temple leaders to construct a new temple building on the side of our land. Despite Siddha's attitude, Srila Prabhupada attempted to encourage him to participate in the new project. He said that whatever differences existed could be resolved on the common platform of chanting the holy names of the Lord. But Siddhaswarup merely invented one excuse after another why he could not participate. So, and of course, that remained that way. They're still out there. They still criticize ISKCON, and what can you do? So you can chant, and if you do chant properly, then there will be, you know, some dissolution of differences and a unity that will form and develop. But if you're very determined to remain separate and to criticize others, then you can chant till you're blue in the face for many lifetimes, but you won't get that result. That's the point. Bahujan Makari Yadi Shravana Kirtana Tabutana Paya Krishna Padi Pramadana. If you are making offenses in the chanting of the holy names and you don't try to resolve them, then you can chant for many lifetimes, Bahu Janma, but you won't get the love of Godhead, which is the ultimate goal of that chanting. So there also has to be the right mentality. But this is the platform for resolving conflicts. That if you have a disagreement with a God brother or God sister, then chant Hare Krishna. I remember Madhavisa Swami, when I first joined, he told me that when he was temple president in San Francisco, I think in 1968 or 69, there were, you know, a few strong personalities there, and they had various disagreements about different things. So he had gone to see Srila Prabhupada to ask what to do about it, and Prabhupada said, just go and have kirtan. So just go and have kirtan, chant together, and then you'll see all your differences are insignificant. So that's what we used to do. Shishi Panchatattva Ki Jai. So I'll just finish this session with one more segment here. The other conflict that I mentioned that was going on was between the Grihasthas and the Sannyasis. And throughout 1975, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, as I mentioned before, he had this Radha Damodara Traveling Sankirtan Party. So he had well over 100 brahmacharis that were roaming all over the country, you know, selling books. And they were doing fantastic service. They were sending about $50,000 a month to the BBT, just that one party. And they were selling tens of thousands of magazines and big books, you know, every month. So Prabhupada was very, very pleased with them. However, when they used to, you know, a party would come rolling into a temple, then any brahmacharis that were in that temple, they'd say, well, what are you staying here for? You should come out on the road with us. You know, this is the real ecstasy, distributing Prabhupada's books, you know, living on the road. This is real renunciation. You're just staying here with a bunch of Grihasthas, because most of the temple presidents were Grihasthas. So, you know, very often in the middle of the night, some brahmachari would suddenly disappear. And then he'd turn up on one of the Radha Damodara buses, you know, in another city somewhere. So the temple presidents were getting very agitated, you know. But so this, you know, conflict developed, and the sannyasis and brahmacharis were, you know, accusing the householders that you're just attached, you know, you're just using the temples for your sense gratification like this. And then the Grihasthas would complain, the sannyasis are just coming and taking all our men. We work hard and preaching and we make new devotees, and then these guys come along and poison them and take them away. So it was becoming a big thing. And it was actually such a big conflict, it got so heavy, that Tamal Krishna Maharaj actually flew from America to Vrindavan when Prabhupada was there during Janmashtami of 75 to make complaints, you know, about what was going on there. Then Prabhupada told him, you just go on with your preaching and, you know, like that. And then he sent him back. And he commented later on, he said, just see, you're spending so much money just to come and complain about a few Grihasthas. So anyway, it didn't stop. We got to Mayapur in 76, and this conflict, you know, came to a head whilst Prabhupada was there in Mayapur. And it was quite contentious. And at one point, Prabhupada actually thought that if it gets any worse, then there'll be a major split in the movement. I remember one particular day, Tamal Krishna Maharaj had come and he was talking with Prabhupada. Then somebody else came. Another GBC came and he was talking on the other side. And they were both explaining their points of view to Srila Prabhupada. And then they went away and Prabhupada had his lunch. And then he went to take rest. Then after about 5 minutes, he rang the bell And I came in to his room and he was sitting up on the bed holding his head. And he said, I can't sleep. He said, this is causing me too much anxiety. He said, this splitting. So I said, well, you know, Prabhupada, it seems, you know, like the Gaudiya Mat broke up because they didn't have a GBC, but we have a GBC and still there's some splitting. And then Prabhupada said, well, what can be done? He said, we cannot hire men to come and manage. We have to do it with our own men. But it was a major headache for him. It was eventually resolved, famously, when Prabhupada sent Tamal Krishna Maharaj to China. And that kind of resolved everything. But in the meantime, anyway, things were building up. And every day something was coming up about this. So one morning walk on March the 10th, again it was being discussed. It was like a seesaw. One party accusing the other. And the last thing Srila Prabhupada wanted was the formation of different factions. He said the whole world is full of isms, different isms. One party against another. We should not bring that attitude into our society. He said the accusations of one side against the other are all fanaticism. He gave the solution. Real unity is in advancing Krishna consciousness. In Kali Yuga, you cannot strictly follow, neither I can strictly follow. If I criticize you, if you criticize me, then we go far away from our real life of Krishna consciousness. You should always remember that either Grihastha or Brahmachari or Sannyasi, nobody can strictly follow all the rules and regulations of them. In the Kali Yuga, it is not possible. So if I find simply fault with you, and if you find fault with me, then it will be factional, and our real business will be hampered. Therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has recommended that Harinama, chanting Hare Krishna mantra, should be very rigidly performed, which is common for everyone, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, or Sannyasi. They should always chant the Hare Krishna mantra. Then everything will be adjusted. Otherwise, it is impossible to advance. We shall be complicated with the details only. On the whole, throughout the discussions, Srila Prabhupada has naturally lent his support to the more renounced position. Yet, he obviously wants everyone to have the chance to develop their Krishna consciousness. He said that we should neither neglect the regulations nor pursue them so fanatically that we miss the point of actual spiritual advancement. He repeated the formula for success. If we advance in Krishna consciousness, then simple method, chanting 24 hours, Kirtaniya Sadahariyi, then things will be automatically adjusted. You cannot find in Kali Yuga that everything is being done very correctly and to the point. That is very difficult. So that is the solution. If you're having problems, sit down and chant. That's all. So I guess that we're supposed to finish at 8 o'clock. Tomorrow night, again, same time. Okay, so we'll continue with this seminar on chanting tomorrow afternoon. And then tomorrow, Bhagavatam class in the morning. And then Prabhupada on chanting in the evening. Now, any other questions before we finish? Yes. That's the example. Somebody new that comes along, if you immediately sit down and try to tell them about, you know, Goloka Vrindavan and Krishna and the gopis, and you know, then you'll actually commit an offense. That's the ninth offense in chanting, to explain the glories of the Lord to those who are not qualified to hear it. In the beginning, people are covered over, so you have to just give them something that's very palatable and easy. That means no philosophy, unless the person's actually inquiring. But even then, you have to be a little careful. Don't give them too much at once. Let them take prasadam and let them chant Hare Krishna. And that will purify them. And then automatically when the heart becomes purified, they'll ask questions and you can give more and more. That was Prabhupada's formula. So that's still true today as much as it was, you know, in 1966 when Prabhupada started preaching. The conditioned souls, you know, they're in the same condition now as they were then. They're ignorant of anything to do with spiritual life. So soften them up first. Let them become a little attracted. That establishes that Shraddha. Ado Shraddha means in the beginning there must be some faith. So you establish a little faith just by making friends with people, that's all. If they think, oh, this is a nice person, that nice woman that I met from the Hare Krishna Society, you know, she gave me a sweet, or, you know, I heard that nice singing, they become a little attracted and automatically they get a mood of respect. When that mood of respect is established, then you can start to give the philosophy. Because if immediately you go up and tell them, you know, what is this? You're eating a hamburger, you nonsense, you dirty meat-eating kami. They're not going to listen to you. But if you say, oh, actually, I have something much nicer to eat than that. Here, try this. Yeah, and you give them a samosa or a pakora, and they eat that. And oh, this is really good, you know. Immediately there's a relationship. Same with the chanting. They go and they see the devotees chanting. They're, you know, bright and effulgent. That was my first meeting, I remember. When I first saw the devotees, I saw them chanting on a street corner in Sydney. I'd just come from England. I emigrated in 1971. And the first day off the boat, we walked down into Sydney and there were the devotees right on the street corner and they were all chanting away. And I didn't understand what it was, but I was immediately attracted by the chanting. I saw these people are in a completely different world. They're on a, you know, consciously they were just on a different platform from everybody else. It was, you know, just there in their demeanor because they were chanting. So I was attracted to that. I didn't know what it was. And I was given actually, I bought a magazine. The girl that sold it to me, her name was Bai Barbie. She was originally from Manchester. She'd only just joined a few months before herself. And now she and her husband, they have the Krishna temple in Utah at Spanish Fork. They have a nice temple that they built there, Chiruan Bai Barbie. So she sold me this magazine. We were standing there watching the devotees chanting and she came around with the magazine and I bought one. And I looked at it and the picture on the front was the Rasa Leela. It was issue number 37. So it had this nice picture of Krishna dancing in the Rasa Leela. And we looked at it and I couldn't figure out what was going on. I had no idea. You know, I looked at that and what is this? You know, I had no recognition at all. And I saw there's this little, looked like a little aeroplane with flowers dropping down and all these little blue men, you know. What is this? And I looked inside and then, you know, there were a few Sanskrit words. And I just could not read it. Even the English, I couldn't read it. Because, you know, the whole thing was so foreign to me. So maybe if I'd just got the magazine and not seen the chanting or anything, maybe I wouldn't have been attracted, I don't know. But I just, you know, the magazine was meaningless at that point. Although I kept it and later on it became very significant. But I mean, you know, the closest that we got to it was, we had one, there was one guy that we met on the boat. His name was Bill. He was from Glasgow, Scottish. So he looked at it when we got back to the hostel that we were staying in. He said, He said, I think they little blue fellas, I think they be spirits. That was as far as we got. You know, that was Krishna. Later on I understood, but, you know, it took a time. It took some time. So, yeah, you know, chanting and prasadam, that's those are the powerful weapons that Prabhupada has given us for removing the influence of Kali Yuga. There's nothing else that will be effective. Only the holy names. That is the Yuga Dharma. So it doesn't matter if somebody comes for years and years, they just come to take prasadam and go home. Fine, we have no objection. That's what we're here for. Sometimes I go to temples and they complained that, oh, this guy's been coming around for 10 years, he's never done anything, he just eats, and, you know, we want to start charging money, or this and that. Well, it's fair enough, if people, you can invite people to give donations, not a problem. But if you say that if you don't give a donation, you can't have prasadam, that is not preaching. That is merely business. Our business is to somehow or another induce people to chant and to take prasadam. And we don't mind if they do it, you know, unlimitedly. Not a problem. Chant, eat, and go away. That's what Prabhupada said. Let them chant, eat, and go home. Eventually they'll get purified, they'll become devotees. Either in this lifetime or the next. But that's our program. Alright? Okay, we should finish there. Srila Prabhupada, oh, one last question. Go on.
Did you have some experiences during your service to Srila Prabhupada, personal service, that he gave some instructions to Vikastas about raising children?
About what?
Raising children.
Raising children. That is a big topic, and we haven't got the time tonight to talk about it.
Okay. So I remember that in your thing is in this Transcendental Diary, once Prabhupada said that actually when the child is like 8 years old, then parents should go, you know, they should separate, and the man should just preach, and the child should go to Gurukula.
Yes. Not should, but can do. Not that it's an order, but if the parents are inclined to dedicate their lives to preaching, then he said that the society should be prepared to look after the children so that the parents are free to go out and preach. But only if they actually do that, not that the parents can dump their children on the society.
Establish this system that Srila Prabhupada is a renounced person, he didn't give any importance to this. And we can see consequently so many destroyed lives actually, young devotees.
Yeah, if you don't understand what Prabhupada was saying correctly, then you'll make mistakes and that'll cause problems. But Prabhupada was not advocating the breakup of families. There's many letters and instructions that he gave where he says very clearly that grihasthas, you know, they have to look after the children very nicely and bring them up in a very loving atmosphere. But as devotees, that's the point. So, I mean, in those days we had very little facility. You know, there was only one or two schools, and Prabhupada advised that you send the kids to the schools there because better for them to be brought up, you know, as devotees than to be brought up through the Kami school system and become, you know, drug takers and alcoholics or whatever, sex mongers or whatever, which is what happens when you send your kids to Kami school. So Prabhupada was trying to establish a new culture, and naturally that new culture will clash with the culture that we were brought up in, because the culture that we were brought up in is, you know, a very degraded culture. You know, you look and see the activities of the teenagers nowadays. From 10 or 11 years onwards, they've just engaged in abominable activities. It's a fact. They're all on drugs, most of them. They're all having sex. Many kids, by the time they're 14 years old, have had abortions. You know, it's a horrible state of affairs, and Prabhupada knew that. So he wanted to set up an alternative culture. But that has been disturbed by devotees carrying over their abominable natures into the realm of Krishna conscious practice. And therefore we had a lot of abuse and things in the schools because these people were not behaving as devotees. They were showing as devotees, but they were not devotees. They were actually behaving in abominable ways. And that has cost us very dearly. But that's not Prabhupada's fault. You read Prabhupada's instructions. He's very clear about how kids can be brought up in a very wonderful way. And if you actually follow that, we've seen the results. There are many kids that have become very nice devotees and were very, very happy that we, you know, they came up through the Gurukul system. So it, you know, it depends on how you apply the instructions. That's the point. Let's finish at that point. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.